fell fast. Frogs cleared their throats. Cicadas whirred like table saws. A woodpecker hammered for grubs. At last came the call of the loons, the theme song of the North Woods, pealing like a laugh or cry, depending on your mood. A car crunched over a dirt road. A dog barked. For a while, people could be heard talking, though their words were too muffled to make out. Knight lived so close to others that he couldn't even sneeze aloud. There's fine cell phone reception at his site. Civilization was right there. Hot showers and creature comforts just steps away. Soon it grew truly dark. One's eyes could be open or closed with hardly a difference. And something moved through the forest. An animal, probably no bigger than a rabbit, though it sounded like a hippo. A couple of stars were visible through the scrim of branches overhead, and the crooked smile of a quarter moon. A bird peeped percussively. Then there was nothing. It was the kind of total quiet that literally made my ears ring. There was not so much as a breeze. Knight, I envisioned, was cowering on his bunk amid the slamming doors of jail, and I felt like an intruder, not on private property, but at his home. I retreated to my tent, feet cold, and turned off my phone and burrowed into my sleeping bag. A volley of bird calls greeted the morning. I unzipped my tent. There was mist in the treetops. Spider webs shone cat's cradle in the dew. Leaves dropped lazily. Autumn was coming, and the air smelled like sap. I turned on my phone and realized I'd rested for 12 hours, my longest sleep in years. Chapter 12. Before Christopher Knight stayed in the woods for a quarter century straight, he never once spent the night in a tent. He grew up less than an hour's drive east of his campsite in the village of Albion, 2,000 people and 4,000 cows. Chris is the fifth child and fifth son of Joyce and Sheldon Knight, following Daniel, Joel, Jonathan, and Timothy. He also has a younger sister, Susanna. His sister, according to Chris, has Down syndrome. Joyce raised the kids, and Sheldon, a Navy veteran who served in Korea, worked in a creamery washing out tanker trucks. They lived in a basic two-story farmhouse with a screened-in front porch on 60 wooded acres with apple trees and raspberry bushes. The Knight children had old-school chores.
"We were country people," said Chris.
They split logs to feed their home's wood-burning stove and picked berries for Joyce's jellies and jams and tended the family's two-acre garden, which they tilled with a tractor. Under their father's tutelage, Chris and his brothers learned to fix what was broken, electrical to automotive, and build what they wanted. One family project was a hut designed by Sheldon and constructed among a stand of cedars on their property. It's both functional and artistic. The walls are made of stone, every rock gathered by one of the boys and carefully stacked and cemented in place. A stove was fashioned from a 55-gallon oil drum, vented with a homemade pipe. The hut was an ideal shelter during deer hunts. Evenings at the Knight residence were usually devoted to reading, each parent in a rocking chair, book in hand. A family friend, Carrie Vieg, said that the inside of the house looked like a library. The Knights subscribed to magazines such as Organic Gardening and Mother Earth News, and they owned the entire Foxfire series of books, which detail rural skills like tanning hides and keeping bees. Chris said that as a child he tore through dozens of Time Life history books available at his elementary school library. Joyce and Sheldon expected academic excellence from their sons, and they received it. Former high school teachers and classmates all described the Knight boys as uncommonly bright. A family of brainiacs, one recalled. More prized by his parents than good grades, Chris mentioned, was Yankee ingenuity. Putting your smarts to work.
It's better to be tough than strong, better to be clever than intelligent, he said, repeating a family maxim. I was tough and clever.
The family frequently experimented with new varieties of seeds to maximize yield. They grew potatoes, beans, pumpkins, and corn.
Basic stuff to fill the bellies of a bunch of boys, said Chris.
The Knights also studied thermodynamics, then built a small greenhouse where they buried hundreds of 1-gallon milk jugs filled with water just below ground level, creating what's known as a heat sink. Due to the nature of the electromagnetic bonds in water molecules, chemists refer to such molecules as sticky, water can store about 4 times more thermal energy than soil. During the day, the water buried in the Knight family greenhouse absorbed heat. After sunset, it slowly released energy. Using this system, they grew food all winter and didn't need to pay a dime to the power company to heat the greenhouse.
In my family, said Chris, self-education, self-improvement was preferred.
Money was tight. Whenever Sheldon came home with coins in his pocket, he dropped them in a coffee can, and Joyce distributed them in the morning before school for milk money. They never got rid of scrap metal or spare parts. Chris described his family as obsessed with privacy. He begged that they not be contacted or disturbed, at least while he was still in jail. The Knights socialized with a small group of friends and relatives, and virtually no one else. One's desire to be alone, biologists have found, is partially genetic and to some degree measurable. If you have low levels of the pituitary peptide oxytocin, sometimes called the master chemical of sociability, and high quantities of the hormone vasopressin, which may suppress your need for affection, you tend to require fewer interpersonal relationships. Each of us inherits from our parents a certain level of need for social inclusion, wrote John Cacioppo in his book, Loneliness. Cacioppo, the director of the Center for Cognitive and Social Neuroscience at the University of Chicago, said that everyone naturally possesses a genetic thermostat for connection. Chris Knight's must be set near absolute zero. Sheldon, Chris's father, died in 2001. Chris didn't know that until his arrest more than a dozen years later. But Joyce, in her 80s, still lives in the same house, along with her daughter, for whom she remains the caretaker. The oldest son, Daniel, 10 years older than Chris, resides in a double-wide mobile home on an adjoining lot. Their closest neighbor, John Boyvin, said he's lived next door to the Knights for 14 years and still hasn't said hello to anyone in the family. Sometimes Boyvin spots Joyce collecting the newspaper. Chris's sister, Susanna, has hardly been seen in public for decades.
I know everyone in Albion, said Amanda Dow, who has worked in the local town office for close to 2 decades. But I can't put a face to them.
People who knew Sheldon invariably described him as introverted. Bob Milliken, an Albion dairy farmer and distant cousin of Sheldon's, said the Knight family was smart, honest, hard-working, self-sufficient, well-respected, and quiet. Milliken added that on the rare occasions when he did speak with anyone in the family, he more or less just stuck to talking about the weather. Chris insisted that he'd had a fine youth.
No complaints. I had good parents.
No one else in his family has had any trouble with the law. 2 of Knight's brothers, Joel and Timothy, visited him in jail, the only members of the family to do so. Chris didn't recognize them, he admitted. Only Joel's laugh sounded familiar.
The brothers said they'd often wondered what had happened to Chris. They had supposed he was dead, but had never expressed this thought to their mother. They'd always wanted to give her hope that he was still alive. It seemed to comfort her. Maybe he's in Texas, they'd say, or he's in the Rocky Mountains, or even New York City. His family apparently never contacted the police about Chris's disappearance. They did not file a missing person report.
They assumed I was off doing something on my own, said Chris, having an adventure. We Yankees, we see the world differently.
Sergeant Hughes said he wasn't particularly surprised to learn that the Knights had not involved the authorities.
They're a rural Maine family, he said. Keep to themselves, people.
As a young boy, when the lilacs bloomed, Chris would gather a bouquet and give them to his mother.
I like the odor and the color, and it's one of the first flowers in spring. I remember thinking I'd found something new, he said.
Otherwise, there were few overt expressions of love.
We didn't feel the need to communicate everything all the time, Chris continued. We're not emotionally bleeding all over each other. We're not touchy-feely. We weren't in the habit of being physically demonstrative. In my family, the boys could not express feelings. We relied on unspoken understandings. That was the way it was.
People who knew Chris as a child called him quiet and shy and nerdy. But no one detected any deeper malaise.
I didn't find him to be all that weird, said Jeff Young, who went to elementary school, junior high, and high school with Chris, and often rode the bus with him. He was a wicked smart kid, and he had a really good sense of humor.
Knight could also be silly and mischievous in a high school sort of way. Young recalled that when they took driver's education classes together, one time Chris deliberately drifted too close to the side of the road, rubbing the car against some bushes. It had recently rained, and the instructor, in the passenger seat with the window open, got drenched. The Knight family never went skiing. They did not eat lobster.
Not our socioeconomics, said Chris.
They owned snowshoes, the long wooden ones with the bear claw bindings. And they fished the local rivers with live bait. In winter, the family would head up to a relative's hunting camp in the North Woods, and the Knight boys would ride snowmobiles until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Once Chris went skydiving with his brother Joel. They listened to the instructions, took off in a small airplane, then jumped out. It was the only plane flight of Chris's life.
Oh, I have taken off in a plane, but I have never landed in one. How amusing.
As the youngest son, Chris was, of course, ribbed by his older brothers. They bestowed upon him the pet name Fudd, perhaps after the cartoon character Elmer Fudd, Rube to Bugs Bunny. Chris detested the name. His parents were strict. Early curfews, finish your homework, no junk food. One cousin, Kevin Nelson, told the Kennebec Journal that he used a bicycle over to the Knight's house carrying treats for the boys. They would lower a string from a bedroom window and they'd raise a bag of snacks, Nelson said. I don't believe they ever had soda pop. Hunting was Sheldon's passion. His obituary in the Morning Sentinel contained a total of 4 words about his leisure time. He enjoyed deer hunting. He kept a bearskin rug at the foot of his bed from a black bear he had shot. Sometimes Chris joined his father on hunts.
A couple of hunting trips, I slept in the back of the pickup, he said, but never alone and never in a tent. I slept in my bed in my family home, where my parents knew exactly where I was.
Chris was once a winner in the Maine Moose License Lottery, a lucky chance. He was 16 years old and went into the woods near the Canadian border with his father, who lent him a .270 Winchester bolt-action rifle.
Chris shot a 750-pound female moose and field-dressed it himself.
I was quite proud. My license, my kill. We ate well that year.
At Lawrence High School, where his class had 224 students, Chris felt invisible. He attended no social events, played no sports, joined no clubs. He never went to a football game, and he skipped the prom, though he did have, he said, two or three friends. His classmate Larry Stewart recalled spending a few evenings hanging out with Chris.
I remember one night in particular, said Stewart. We were driving around in a guy's car, and Chris was in the back seat. We just did what kids do up in Maine. We didn't tip over any cows or anything, but maybe we snuck a few drinks out of someone's beer, or drove around the old concourse listening to Foreigner and Aerosmith, and went to McDonald's or something. Chris was smart and friendly. I never noticed anything odd about him, but who knows what was really going on. Us Mainers, we have our own way of doing things. We like to hold our peacoats and our family really close.
One day, Chris and Jeff Young decided to skip school and go fishing.
We planned it the day before, said Young, and took our fishing rods to school, just the two of us. I think he didn't like being around too many people, and I don't blame him.
We walked 2 or 3 miles, heading to the old metal bridge over the Sebasticook River.
We never made it.
Sheldon must have suspected something, for he drove by in his red Dodge pickup. Chris had respect for his father, Young observed, and perhaps a little fear of him. Without saying a word, Chris just got in the truck and left. During his senior year, Knight, like most Maine public school students, attended a course called Hunter Safety and Outdoor Skills. He learned things like how to read a compass and how to construct a makeshift shelter.
This is something that keeps replaying in my mind, said his teacher, Bruce Hillman. I told every kid that if you were in a survival situation, life or death, and you come upon a camp, it's okay to break in. This is accepted in Maine. I have a camp, too, and I always leave dry goods behind just in case others need it. You never know what impact you're going to have on some kid. I was thinking of a survival situation lasting 2 or 3 days, not 20 years.
The early 1980s brought the first generation of personal computers, and Knight was fascinated. One might expect him to be a technophobe, but he was actually an early adopter. His future plan, according to the yearbook, was to be a computer technician. His nickname, unsatisfyingly, was Knight. His favorite subject was history.
I hated gym, he said. I hated gym teachers. What's that Woody Allen line? Those who can't do, teach. And those who can't teach, teach gym.
I figured out a way of skipping gym class by going to study hall instead. And I weaseled my way out of 4 years of high school gym. I'm in good shape. I'm above average height. I just didn't want to play on teams. Being in gym class made me feel like I was trapped in Lord of the Flies. Can you really expect to see me playing volleyball?
Upon graduation, Knight enrolled in a 9-month electronics course, whose curriculum included computer repair, at Sylvania Technical School in Waltham, Massachusetts, outside Boston. Two of his brothers had taken the same course. After he finished, he stayed in Waltham, where he found a job installing home and vehicle alarm systems, useful knowledge to have for his later career as a burglar. He rented a room in a house and purchased a new vehicle, a white 1985 Subaru Brat. His brother Joel co-signed the loan.
He did such a nice thing for me, and I screwed him on that, Knight said. I still owe him.
He worked for less than a year, and then suddenly, without giving notice to his boss, quit the alarm installation job. Knight never even returned his work tools, according to Carrie Vieg, the longtime family friend. His employer, irate, contacted Chris's family and demanded several $100s in reimbursement for the missing tools, threatening legal action if they refused. Chris's parents, recalled Vig, ended up paying. Chris, meanwhile, cashed his final paycheck and left town. He did not tell anyone where he was going.
I had no one to tell, he said. I didn't have any friends. I had no interest in my co-workers.
He drove the brat south. He was 20 years old. He ate fast food and stayed in cheap motels,
the cheapest I could find,
and drove for days alone until he found himself deep into Florida. He did not mention stopping at any tourist sites or museums or beaches. He stuck mostly to the interstate and apparently didn't do much except sit in his car and watch the world sealed off behind metal and glass. Eventually he turned around and headed north. He listened to the radio. Ronald Reagan was president. The Chernobyl nuclear disaster had just occurred. Something happened to Chris on that drive. The first and only road trip of his life. He headed north through Georgia and the Carolinas and Virginia, blessed with the invincibility of youth, buzzed by the pleasure of driving. And an idea grew into a realization, then solidified into a resolve. All his life, he'd been comfortable being alone. Interacting with others was so often frustrating. Every meeting with another person seemed like a collision. As he drove, perhaps he felt within himself some rumblings of fear and thrill, as if at the precipice of a radical leap. He continued all the way back to Maine. There aren't many roads in the center of the state, and he chose the one that went right by his house. It wasn't a coincidence.
I think it was just to have one last look around, to say goodbye.
He didn't stop. The last time he saw his family home was through the windshield of the brat. He kept going,
up and up and up.
Soon he reached the shore of Moosehead Lake, the largest lake in Maine, where the state begins to get truly remote.
I drove until I was nearly out of gas. I took a small road, then a small road off that small road, then a trail off that.
He went as far into the wilderness as his vehicle could take him. He parked the car and put the keys on the center console. He had a tent and a backpack, but no compass, no map. Without knowing where he was going, with no particular place in mind, he stepped into the trees and walked away. Chapter 13. But why? Why would a 20-year-old kid with a job and a car and a brain abruptly abandon the world? The act had elements of a suicide, except he didn't kill himself.
To the rest of the world, I ceased to exist, said Knight.
His family must have suffered. They had no idea what had happened to him, and couldn't completely accept that he was dead. When his father died 15 years after the disappearance, Knight was still listed as a survivor in the obituary. His final moment as a member of society,
I just tossed the keys on the center console,
seemed particularly strange. Knight was raised with a keen appreciation for the value of money, and the brat was the most expensive item he'd ever purchased. The car was less than a year old, and he threw it away. Why not hold on to the keys as a safety net? What if he didn't like camping out?
The car was of no use to me. It had just about zero gas, and was miles and miles from any gas station.
As far as anyone knows, the brat is still there, half swallowed by the forest, a set of keys somewhere within, by this point as much a part of the wilderness as a product of civilization. perhaps like Knight himself. Knight said that he didn't really know why he left. He'd given the question plenty of thought, but had never arrived at an answer.
"It's a mystery," he declared.
There was no specific cause he could name. No childhood trauma, no sexual abuse. There wasn't alcoholism in his home, or violence. He wasn't trying to hide anything, to cover a wrongdoing, to evade confusion about his sexuality. Anyway, none of these burdens typically produces a hermit. There's a sea of names for hermits. Recluses, monks, misanthropes, ascetics, anchorites, swamis. Yet no solid definitions or qualification standards, except the desire to be primarily alone. Some hermits have tolerated steady streams of visitors, or lived in cities, or holed up in university laboratories. But you can take virtually all the hermits in history and divide them into three general groups to explain why they hid. Protesters, pilgrims, pursuers. Protesters are hermits whose primary reason for leaving is hatred of what the world has become. Some cite wars as their motive, or environmental destruction, or crime, or consumerism, or poverty, or wealth. These hermits often wonder how the rest of the world can be so blind not to notice what we're doing to ourselves. "I have become solitary," wrote the 18th-century French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, "because to me the most desolate solitude seems preferable to the society of wicked men which is nourished only in betrayals and hatred." Across much of Chinese history, it was customary to protest a corrupt emperor by leaving society and moving into the mountainous interior of the country. People who withdrew often came from the upper classes and were highly educated. Hermit protesters were so esteemed in China that a few times, tradition holds, when a non-corrupt emperor was seeking a successor, he passed over members of his own family and selected a solitary. Most turned down the offer, having found peace in reclusion. The first great literary work about solitude, the Tao Te Ching, was written in ancient China, likely in the 6th century BC, by a protester hermit named Lao Tzu. The book's 81 short verses describe the pleasures of forsaking society and living in harmony with the seasons. The Tao Te Ching says that it is only through retreat rather than pursuit, through inaction rather than action, that we acquire wisdom. "Those with less become content," says the Tao. "Those with more become confused." The poems, still widely read, have been hailed as a hermit manifesto for more than 2,000 years. Around 1 million protester hermits are living in Japan right now. They're called hikikomori, pulling inward. And the majority are males, aged late teens and up, who have rejected Japan's competitive, conformist, pressure cooker culture. They have retreated into their childhood bedrooms and almost never emerge, in many cases for more than a decade. They pass the day reading or surfing the web. Their parents deliver meals to their doors, and psychologists offer them counseling online. The media has called them the lost generation and the missing million. Pilgrims, religious hermits, are by far the largest group. The connection between seclusion and spiritual awakening is profound. Jesus of Nazareth, after his baptism in the River Jordan, withdrew to the wilderness and lived alone for 40 days, then began attracting his apostles. Siddhartha Gautama, in about 450 BC, according to one version of the story, sat beneath a peepal tree in India, meditated for 49 days, and became Buddha. Tradition holds that the prophet Muhammad in AD 610 was on a retreat in a cave near Mecca when an angel revealed to him the first of many verses that would become the Quran. In Hindu philosophy, Everyone, ideally, matures into a hermit. Becoming a sadhu, renouncing all familial and material attachments, and turning to ritual worship, is the fourth and final stage of life. Some sadhus file their own death certificates, as their lives are considered terminated, and they are legally dead to the nation of India. There are at least 4 million sadhus in India today. During the Middle Ages, after the desert fathers and mothers of Egypt died out, a new form of Christian solitary emerged, this time in Europe. They were called anchorites. The name is derived from an ancient Greek word for withdrawal. And they lived alone in tiny dark cells, usually attached to the outer wall of a church. The ceremony initiating a new anchorite often included the last rites, and the cell's doorway was sometimes bricked over. Anchorites were expected to remain in their cells for the rest of their lives. In some cases, they did so for over 40 years. This existence, they believed, would offer an intimate connection with God and salvation. Servants delivered food and emptied chamber pots through a small opening. Virtually every large town across France, Italy, Spain, Germany, England, and Greece had an anchorite. In many areas, there were more females than males. A woman's life in the Middle Ages was severely bound, and to become an anchorite, unburdened by social strictures or domestic toil, may have felt paradoxically emancipating. Scholars have called anchorites the progenitors of modern feminism. Pursuers are the most modern type of hermits. Rather than fleeing society, like protesters, or living beholden to higher powers, like pilgrims, pursuers seek alone time for artistic freedom, scientific insight, or deeper self-understanding. Thoreau went to Walden to journey within, to explore the private sea, the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean of one's being. An endless list of writers and painters and philosophers and scientists have been described as hermits, including Charles Darwin, Thomas Edison, Emily Bronte, and Vincent van Gogh. Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick, largely withdrew from public life for 30 years. "All profound things," he wrote, "are preceded and attended by silence." Flannery O'Connor rarely left her rural farm in Georgia. Albert Einstein referred to himself as a loner in daily life. The American essayist William Dershowitz wrote that no real excellence, personal or social, artistic, philosophical, scientific or moral, can arise without solitude. The historian Edward Gibbon said that solitude is the school of genius. Plato, Descartes, Kierkegaard, and Kafka have all been described as solitaries. "Not till we have lost the world," wrote Thoreau, "do we begin to find ourselves." "Thoreau," said Chris Knight, offering his appraisal of the great transcendentalist, "was a dilettante." Perhaps he was. Thoreau spent 2 years and 2 months, starting in 1845, at his cabin on Walden Pond in Massachusetts. He socialized in the town of Concord. He often dined with his mother. "I had more visitors while I lived in the woods than at any other period in my life," he wrote. One dinner party at his place numbered 20 guests. While Knight lived in the woods, he didn't think of himself as a hermit. He never put a label on who he was. But when speaking of Thoreau, he used a particular phrase. Knight said that Thoreau was not a true hermit. Thoreau's biggest sin may have been publishing Walden. Knight said that writing a book, packaging one's thoughts into a commodity, is not something a true hermit would do. Nor is hosting a party or hobnobbing in town. These actions are directed outward, towards society. They all shout in some way, "Here I am." Yet almost every hermit communicates with the outside world. Following the Tao Te Ching, so many protester hermits in China wrote poems, including poet monks known as Cold Mountain, Pickup, Big Shield, and Stonehouse, that the genre was given its own name, Shan Shui. St. Anthony was one of the first desert fathers, and the inspiration for thousands of Christian hermits who followed. Around A.D. 270, Anthony moved into an empty tomb in Egypt, where he stayed alone for more than a decade. He then lived in an abandoned fort for 20 years more, subsisting only on bread, salt, and water delivered by attendants, sleeping on the bare ground, never bathing, devoting his life to intense and often agonizing piety. According to his biographer, St. Athanasius of Alexandria, who met with him in person, Anthony ended his retreat with a pure soul and would go to heaven. But for much of his time in the desert, the biography adds, Anthony was inundated by parishioners seeking counsel. "The crowds," Anthony said, "do not permit me to be alone." Even the anchorites, locked up by themselves for life, were not separate from medieval society. Their cells were often in town, and most had a window through which they counseled visitors. People realized that speaking with a sympathetic anchorite could be more soothing than praying to a remote and unflinching god. Anchorites gained widespread fame as sages, and for several centuries much of the population of Europe discussed great matters of life and death with hermits. In the forest, night never snapped a photo, had no guests over for dinner, and did not write a sentence. His back was fully turned to the world. None of the hermit categories fit him properly. There was no clear why. Something he couldn't quite feel had tugged him away from the world with the persistence of gravity. He was one of the longest-enduring solitaries, and among the most fervent as well. Christopher Knight was a true hermit.
"I can't explain my actions," he said. "I had no plans when I left. I wasn't thinking of anything. I just did it."
Chapter 14. Knight actually did have a plan, or maybe it was the opposite of a plan. Regardless, he had a goal: to get lost. Not just lost to the rest of the world, but actually lost in the woods by himself. He carried only rudimentary camping supplies, a few articles of clothing, and a little food.
"I had what I had," he said, "and nothing more."
He left the keys in the car and vanished into the forest. It's not that easy to get lost. Anyone with basic outdoor skills generally knows which way they're going. The sun burns west across the sky, and from there it's natural to set the other directions. Knight knew that he was heading south. He said he didn't make a conscious decision, but felt pulled like a homing pigeon.
There was no depth or substance to the idea. It was at the instinctual level. It's instinct among animals to return to home territory. And my home ground, where I was born and raised, was that way.
Maine is partitioned into a series of long north-south valleys, the geologic claw mark left by glaciers surging and retreating. Separating the valleys are strings of mountains, now weather-worn and bald-topped like old men. But only a couple of dozen million years ago, the Appalachians were mightier than the Rockies. The valley floors at the time of year when Knight arrived were a summer soup of ponds and wetlands and bogs.
"I kept largely to the ridges," Knight said, "and sometimes crossed swamps going from one ridge to another."
He worked his way along crumbled slopes and muddy taiga.
"Soon I lost track of where I was. I didn't care."
Virtually every natural feature in Maine, pond to peak, has a proper name, but Knight saw such titles as human impositions and preferred not to know them. He sought a purity to his retreat beyond all measure. There were no signs saying, "You are here." It was either dry land or wet land. I knew where I was, but I didn't know where I was. Oh, I'm getting all metaphysical here, aren't I? He was unfettered by the rules of society, king of his own jungle, and alone and lost in the forest, a quilt of dreams and nightmares both. Knight mostly liked it. He'd camp in one spot for a week or so, then head south yet again. "I kept going," he said. "I was content in the choice I had made. Content except for one thing. Food. He was hungry, and he really didn't know how he'd feed himself. His departure was a confounding mix of incredible commitment and complete lack of forethought, not all that abnormal for a 20-year-old. It was as if he went camping for the weekend and didn't come home for a quarter century. He was an able hunter and angler, but he carried neither a gun nor a rod. He didn't want to die, at least not then. His idea was to forage for food. The wilds of Maine are enchanting to behold and monumentally broad, though not generous. There are no fruit trees. Berries sometimes have a weekend-long season. Without hunting or trapping or fishing, you're going to starve. Knight worked his way south, eating very little, until paved roads appeared. He found a road-killed partridge, but did not possess a stove or a way to easily start a fire, so he ate it raw. Neither a tasty meal nor a hearty one, and a good way to get sick. He passed houses with gardens. Knight was raised with rigid morals and a great deal of pride. You make do on your own, always. No handouts or government assistance, ever. You know what's right and what's wrong, and the dividing line is usually clear. But try not eating for 10 days. Nearly everyone's restraints will be eroded. Hunger is hard to ignore. It took a while to overcome my scruples, Knight said, but as soon as his scruples fell, he snapped off a few ears of corn, dug up some potatoes, and ate a couple of green vegetables. One time, during his first weeks away, he spent the night in an unoccupied cabin. It was a miserable experience. The stress of that, the sleepless worry about getting caught, programmed me not to do that again. He never slept indoors after that. Not once. No matter how cold or rainy the weather. He continued moving south, picking through gardens, and eventually reached a region with a familiar distribution of trees, a diversity of bird calls and bugs he recognized, and a temperature range he felt accustomed to. It had been colder up north. He wasn't sure precisely where he was, but he knew it was home ground. It turned out that he was less than 30 miles as the crow flies from his childhood home. He came upon a pair of lakes, one large and one small, with cabins all around and plenty of small gardens offering easy snacking. Knight hoped to stay a while, but there seemed to be no good place to camp, nothing offering both comfort and seclusion. In the early days of his escape, nearly everything Knight learned was through trial and error, with the great hope that no error would end his seclusion. He had been gifted with a good head for figuring out workable solutions to complicated problems. All his skills, from the rigging of tarps to rainwater filtration to walking through the forest without leaving tracks, went through multiple versions and were never considered perfect. Tinkering with his systems was one of Knight's hobbies. For a while, he tried living in a river bank. The bank was tall and steep, and the stream offered a nice trickling soundscape. With a stolen shovel, Knight tunneled deep into the bank, reinforcing the walls and ceilings with scavenged wood, so that the dwelling resembled an old mine shaft. It wasn't acceptable,
He was basically living in a hole, cold and damp, with hardly enough room to sit up. It was well camouflaged, but the forest around the cave offered far too easy walking. And indeed the spot was eventually discovered by deer hunters long after night had abandoned it. The cave became a pilgrimage site for locals seeking answers to the hermit legend, though no one was sure if it had actually been constructed by him, or even if there was a hermit at all. Knight tried at least 6 other places in the area over a span of several months without satisfaction. Finally, he stumbled upon a region of nasty, boulder-choked woods without so much as a game trail running through it, far too harsh for hikers. He'd found the Jazi, and he liked it immediately. Then he discovered the Elephant Rocks with the hidden opening.
I knew at once it was ideal, so I settled in.
He still remained hungry. He wanted more than vegetables, and even if he did stick with gardens, the main summer, as every local knows, is that rare, lovely guest who leaves your house early. Once it ended, Knight understood, for the next 8 months, the gardens and cornfields would lay fallow beyond snacking. Knight was realizing something almost every hermit in history has discovered. You can't actually live by yourself all the time. You need help. Hermits often end up in deserts and mountains and boreal woodlands, the sorts of places where it's nearly impossible to generate all your own food. To feed themselves, several desert fathers wove reed baskets, which their assistants sold in town, using the proceeds to buy rations. In ancient China, hermits were shamans and herbalists and diviners. English hermits took jobs as toll collectors, beekeepers, woodcutters, and bookbinders. Many were beggars. In 18th-century England, a fad swept the upper class. Several families felt their estate needed a hermit, and advertisements were placed in newspapers for ornamental hermits who were slack in grooming and willing to sleep in a cave. The job paid well, and hundreds of hermits were hired, typically on 7-year contracts, with 1 meal a day included. Some would emerge at dinner parties and greet guests. The English aristocracy of this period believed hermits radiated kindness and thoughtfulness, and for a couple of decades it was deemed worthy to keep one around. Knight, of course, felt that anyone's willing assistance tainted the whole thing. Either you are hidden or you're not. No middle ground. He wished to be unconditionally alone, exiled to an island of his own creation, an uncontacted tribe of one. A single phone call letting his parents know he was okay, and suddenly there would be a connection. The cabins around the ponds, Knight noted, had minimal security measures. Windows were often left open, even when the owners were away. The woods offered excellent cover, and with few permanent residents, the area would soon be empty for the off-season. A summer camp with a big pantry was nearby. The easiest way to become a hunter-gatherer here was obvious. And so Knight came to a conclusion. He decided to steal. Chapter 15. To commit 1,000 break-ins before getting caught, a world-class streak, requires precision and patience and daring and luck. It also demands a specific understanding of people.
I looked for patterns, Knight said. Everyone has patterns.
Knight perched at the edge of the woods and meticulously observed the families of North Pond. Quiet breakfast to dinner parties, visitors to vacancies, cars up and down the road, like some Jane Goodall of the human race. Nothing he saw tempted him to return. He wasn't a voyeur, he insisted. His surveillance was clinical, informational, mathematical. He did not learn anyone's name. All he sought was to understand migration patterns, when people went shopping, when a cabin was unoccupied.
He watched the families move about and knew when he could steal. After that, he said, everything in his life became a matter of timing. The ideal time to steal was deep in the night, midweek, preferably when it was overcast, best in the rain. A heavy downpour was prime. People stayed out of the woods when it was nasty, and night wished to avoid encounters. Still, he did not walk on roads or trails, just in case, and he never launched a raid on a Friday or Saturday, days he knew had arrived from the obvious surge in lakeside noise. A constant dilemma was the moon question. For a while, he opted to go out when the moon was large, so he could use it as a light source and have little need for a flashlight. In later years, when he suspected the police had intensified their search for him, and he'd memorized much of the forest, he switched to no moon at all, preferring the cover of darkness. He liked to vary his methods, and he even varied how often he varied them. He didn't want to develop any patterns of his own, though he did make it a habit to embark on a raid only when freshly shaved, or with a neatly groomed beard and wearing clean clothing, to reduce suspicion on the slight chance that he was spotted. There were at least 100 cabins in Knight's repertoire.
100 might be a low number.
In addition to the providential pine tree kitchen, and he continually shuffled the ones he broke into. The ideal was a fully stocked place, with the family away until the weekend. He knew, in many cases, the precise number of steps required to reach a particular cabin, and once he selected a target, he bounded and wove through the forest, a touch of Tarzan to his style.
"I have woodscraft,"
Knight acknowledged, choosing an elegant term. Sometimes, if he was headed far or needed a load of propane or a replacement mattress, his occasionally grew moldy, it was easier to travel by canoe. He never stole one. Canoes are difficult to hide, and if you steal one, the owner will call the police. It was wiser to borrow. There was a large selection around the lake, some up on sawhorses and seldom used. Almost no one calls the authorities if they suspect their canoe has been borrowed and returned undamaged. Knight was capable of reaching homes anywhere on the two ponds.
"I'd think nothing of paddling for hours, whatever needed to be done."
If the water was choppy, he'd place a few rocks in the front to keep the boat stable. He'd typically stick close to shore, cloaked against the trees, hiding in the silhouette of the land, though once in a while, on a stormy night, he'd paddle across the middle, alone in the dark and lashed by the rain. When he arrived at his chosen cabin, he'd make sure there were no vehicles in the driveway, no sign of someone inside, all the obvious things. This wasn't sufficient. Burglary is a dicey enterprise, a felony offense, with a low margin for error. One mistake and the outside world would snatch him back. So he crouched in the dark and waited. 2 hours. 3 hours. 4 hours. More. He needed to be sure no one was nearby. No one was watching. No one had called the police. This was not difficult for him. Patience is his forte.
"I enjoy being in the dark. Camouflage is my instinct. My favorite colors are those that help me blend in. Dark green, a shade darker than John Deere green, is my favorite color."
He never risked breaking into a home occupied year-round. Too many variables. And he always wore a watch so he could monitor the time. Knight, like a vampire, did not want to stay out past sunrise. Sometimes, especially in the early years, a few cabins were left unlocked. Those were the easiest to enter, though soon other places, and later the pine tree freezer, became nearly as simple. Knight had keys to them, ones he'd found during previous break-ins. Rather than travel around with a big jangling keychain, he stashed each key on its property, typically under some nondescript rock, He created several dozen of these stashes and never forgot where one was. He noticed when several cabins left out pens and paper, requesting a shopping list, and others offered him bags of books hanging from a doorknob. But he was fearful of traps or tricks or initiating any sort of correspondence, even a grocery list. So he left everything untouched, and the trend faded away. For the majority of his break-ins, Knight worked the lock on a window or door. He always carried his lock-breaking kit, a gym bag with a collection of screwdrivers and flat bars and files, and he could defeat all but the most fortified bolts with the perfect little jiggle of just the right tool, less about muscle and more like Houdini. If you had a really sophisticated door lock, he'd go in through a window. The idea of smashing glass or kicking down a door was appalling to Knight, the purview of barbarians. When he was finished stealing, he would often reseal the hasp on the window he'd unlatched and exit through the front door, making sure the handle was set, if possible, to lock up behind himself. No need to leave the place vulnerable to thieves. As the residents of North Pond invested in security upgrades, Knight adapted. He knew about alarms from his one paying job, and he used this knowledge to continue stealing, sometimes disabling systems or removing memory cards from surveillance cameras, before they became smaller and better hidden. He evaded dozens of attempts to catch him by both police officers and private citizens. One time, Sergeant Hughes served as driver for a search party that included officers from the state police. Everyone piled into the back of Hughes's four-wheel drive truck, and they drove the rugged forest roads, stopping frequently to investigate on foot. "We searched and searched and never did find the hermit or his camp," said Hughes. With the vigilantes, including the man who'd spent more than a dozen nights lying in wait with his gun, Knight either sensed their presence or got a bit lucky. The crime scenes themselves were so clean that the authorities offered their begrudging respect. "The level of discipline he showed while he broke into houses," said Hughes, "is beyond what any of us can remotely imagine. The legwork, the reconnaissance, the talent with locks, his ability to get in and out without being detected." A burglary report filed by one police officer specifically noted the crime's unusual neatness. The hermit, many officers felt, was a master thief. It was as if he were showing off, picking locks, yet stealing little, playing a strange sort of game. Knight said that the moment he opened a lock and entered a home, he always felt a hot wave of shame. "Every time, I was very conscious that I was doing wrong. I took no pleasure in it. None at all." Once inside a cabin, he moved purposefully, hitting the kitchen first before making a quick sweep of the house, looking for any useful items or the batteries he always required. He never turned on a light. He used only a small flashlight attached to a metal chain he wore around his neck. This style allowed him to leave the light dangling if he needed it in the forest, and it would illuminate only the ground, keeping his face shadowed. Knight detested headlamps. They scattered light everywhere, bright as a bar sign. During a burglary, there wasn't a moment's ease. "My adrenaline was spiking, my heart rate was soaring, my blood pressure was high. I was always scared when stealing. Always. I wanted it over as quickly as possible." The only time he paused for more than a moment during a raid was when the weather was cold and he needed to thaw something out. If meat was frozen, he'd pop it in the microwave. He'd finish with the inside of the cabin, then, by habit, check the gas grill to see if the propane tank was full. If so, and there was an empty spare lying around, he'd replace the full one with an empty, making the grill appear untouched. It was always best, Knight believed, for a homeowner to have no clear evidence that he or she had been robbed. Then he'd load everything into a canoe, if it was a canoe borrowing trip, and paddle to the shore closest to his camp and unload. He'd return the canoe to the spot he'd taken it from, sprinkle some pine needles on the boat to make it appear unused, then haul his loot up through the Jarzee, between the elephant rocks, to his site. By this point,